Well, happy new year, everybody. Thank you for joining us. I am Mark Chaffardini with Go See Talk. I am thrilled to be introducing our next guest. This infinitely talented composer released his first album at 16 and since then has been kicking ass, making soundtrack history, working with legendary filmmakers, well on his way to being a legend himself. He puts the USS Callister into warp speed. He makes reverb sound like Ravel. Can turn ones and zeros into a symphony. He can out-Beatle the Beatles. He is the Excalibur in any filmmaker's arsenal. Welcome our first guest of 2021, Daniel Pemberton.
Okay, interesting intro, but thank you.
I love your work.
Oh, good. Thanks very much. Interview's off to a good start.
You got so much going on. Every one of your scores is just like a symphony in itself. You love to dig deep from what I hear in interviews and things that I can piece together from listening to your tracks. I'd love to get into all that, but please, why don't we go back to the very beginning? What instrument, whether it's the one on the wall or a symphony you heard as a young age, what got you into this impressive profession?
I got very into electronic music when I was sort of young. I wasn't actually that excited about things, and then my dad took me to a planetarium that was in, which is now Madame Tussauds in Baker Street. And they used to have a planetarium there. Now it's some like awful Meet the Marvel superheroes room. But it used to be a planetarium. And I went to see a show there and it had lasers and crazy synthesizer music. And I had no idea. I'd never heard anything like this. There's a lot of like Jean-Michel Jarre and Vangelis. And I heard that and it just literally like flicked a switch in my head. I was suddenly like, oh my God, what the hell is this? And the next day, my dad got me a couple of records from the library, which was one called Rendezvous by Jean-Michel Jarre and one called Amadorn by Mike Oldfield. And then I basically copied those onto a tape. I mean, obviously don't pirate things, kids. And listened to them nonstop pretty much for a year and just became obsessed by these records and the sound worlds they're creating. And I was kind of getting interested in music up to that point, but that was the real moment where it really just exploded. And I think a lot of that was to do with the fact that I've always been really interested in sound worlds and like the kind of immersive atmospheric world of sound, as well as the sort of storytelling aspects.
Did you get into any Brian Eno or space music? You know, there's an interesting podcast called Hearts of Space, which has all that kind of sound.
Say that again, the first bit.
Brian Eno.
Oh yeah. I basically like got super into ambient music. I caned every Brian Eno record. I caned everything I could from that. Yeah. I mean, there was a really interesting scene in Britain around 1994 that was this kind of new technology cusp. Internet was just kind of emerging, this sort of future thinking, positive kind of conceptual ideas of what the future could hold. And music was a big part of that. And there was a really interesting scene, particularly in London, of kind of quite experimental avant-garde electronic ambient music with people like the Future Sound London and the Orb. Brian Eno was obviously kind of quite a big influence on that scene. And I got really, really sucked into that. I mean, I found it like amazing. I used to go to these like crazy rave squat parties in like crazy parts of London that I was only like 15 and be going to these like all night raves, just listening to music. I got really, really into a bunch of things in that scene, but one of the things I found most exciting was the lack of rules around the musical structure and what music could be. Whereas previously, all the music I'd heard had always often been kind of very much put together in a sort of way that was very conventional in terms of structure, in terms of what it could be. Whereas this was, you know, it's like sound effects. It was songs that could go in totally different directions halfway through and completely change or do nothing or just loop around for ages. But I just really loved the fact that suddenly there was this canvas and palette that was like infinite.
Well, you know, you have a track on your the Bedroom album called Antarctica, which just kind of does that. It kind of goes on and evolves. And I noticed that you do some of the similar things with the trial of the Chicago Seven. There's the Taking the Hill, where it's this progressive sort of, you know, like an iceberg, you know, just, or a glacier just moving towards you. Did you meet anybody who kind of, you know, shared a similar vision and you picked up on the same style of music at these raves?
I mean, look, I used to be this really annoying kid who just turned up and like ask everyone questions. But for me, I was just absorbing everything I could to do with like the scene, the sound. Like I just was really into trying to understand how to make these sounds, how to kind of create different kind of music. I kind of got like, the thing I found a bit uninspiring was the fact that I felt like the ambition in the records often wasn't there. It was often like, we've created this thing and that's fine. And I've always tried to be quite ambitious with what I do musically, which isn't always a good thing because sometimes it just means you go over the top and throw too many things into the pan, so to speak. But I was very much like a kind of, I don't want to say magpie, but like I was just like a big sponge absorbing as much as I could, like sonically and kind of experientially, like just sort of just going to all these crazy places. I was doing stuff with Ninja Tune, even that record label. I used to work with them very early on. And I had Bedroom came out on this German label called Fax, which was like this quite cult, like ambient sort of avant-garde electronic label. But it's hard to know. I don't think I've ever met anyone who had like the same kind of thing as me, because I was really young. I was like 15 or 16. So I was like a real weird novelty in some ways, because I think this was before the internet really existed. Like it was starting to grow. It was existing at this point, but the only way you could find out culture or underground culture or anything unusual was kind of by experiencing it or having people tell you about it. And so you'd have to kind of build these networks of people and then find where other things were, which is like really exciting. But now I think it's actually, there's like a real positive and negative to now. I think what's great about now is it kind of has democratized people's access to information and access to culture. But then at the same time, it kind of like just means everything gets spat out within 2 seconds, really. And a scene like that would never exist today. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, do you think that it's more to that point, the idea of discovering something, that there's less of a discovery because, like you said, it just hits you all at once. You know, there's, you know, when people say things like the dark web or these things that are sort of underground, yeah, you know, do you still kind of look towards undiscovered places for inspiration or?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is like it all comes down to like, I don't know, all of music really is about emotional response. And so I always say there's no such thing as a bad record. It's just the context of the record. So let's say a record you think is rubbish, and I might choose a Spice Girls B-side that I don't like or something. I don't know. Like, I might be like, this song is terrible. I hate it. I never want to hear it. But if I'd never heard any music or never heard any pop music, it would probably sound like the most phenomenal record I've ever heard in my life, piece of music. And what happens is you kind of get ground down by the... When you hear something over and over again, or an idea over and over again, it loses its magic and it loses its initial hit. And if you want to tie this to what I'm doing, trying to do as a composer, is I'm always trying to find something, if I can, that gives you a kind of more synaptic emotional rush when you hear a piece of music, because hopefully it's doing something you haven't experienced before. Now, that's the idea. The reality is it's really fucking hard to do that. But that's what I'm kind of aiming for, because I kind of feel you can do these big chords or big dun, 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 sort of string parts and thumpy drums, but you know, you've seen them a million times. It's like trailer music at the moment where it's the same thing every time. Ping, ping, dun, weird cover version of an old song, and then dun, 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 comes in. Now, the first time that happened, it was fucking great and it was amazing and you're like, whew. but you know, you watch every trailer now and it's exactly the same and it's so boring and you just like, you know what's going to happen. So as a result, something that like even like 5 years ago was really exciting now is really boring because you've seen it a million times and makes you switch off. So a lot of it is trying to find something new, even if the new is the old of like, you know, even if it's just something as basic as trying to do more melodic scoring because everyone's so used to like sound-based scores. Sure. It's always trying to find ways to excite. I'm always thinking about how do you excite the audience and give them something that feels like a new experience.
Well, I think you did that with something like USS Callister, which in a way there was a sort of an homage, a bit of a campiness to it. But then you get to the end, and I mean, talk about polar opposites. I mean, it's sort of the same vibe, but you know, not 2.0, it's like 7.0. You just took what you expected or heard and just, you know, went to warp speed with it. So
yeah, Callister was interesting because I was like, I always wanted to do a Black Mirror. And then they give me that one. I'm like, you just give me the most complicated episode of Black Mirror to ever do. Like, I was like, can't I do the one where I make like weird electronic drones and everyone thinks it's really cool rather than the hyper complex, two different storylines that have to have two different types of story. Like, you know, you have this one storyline that is like 1950s Star Trek that has to sound like a kind of old Jerry Goldsmith style Star Trek score. And then you have another aspect, which is like now, which is like a kind of like slightly into the future, modernist synth-based score. And then those two things have to slowly merge as those two different worlds become closer and closer and then work together. So yeah, that was an interesting challenge. But the thing that made that, I guess, feel different was the fact that you're combining these two ideas, which on their own, you know, the 1950s Star Trek thing, obviously people have heard a lot and experienced, but maybe not in the context of a Black Mirror. So that makes it a bit more interesting. And like, you know, sort of slightly like into the future synth stuff, everyone's kind of heard, but it's like trying to marry those two worlds hopefully gives you something slightly different.
And I think the way you layered it, there's almost three melodies happening at the same time in the end credits music. There's like, there's the classical horns, but then there's the doodle-doodle-doodle-doodle-doodle-doodle-doodle, and then the main driving theme, which is just, it all works so well.
I'm glad you listened to the end credits on Netflix. I don't know how much you know about me, but one of the things that really, really gets me wound up is how Netflix, Amazon, and everyone else treats end credits. And that is a good case in point because the end credits on Callister, the music is actually very thought about for that end credit, like literally end credit roller, because that's like their next adventures. But the music represents everything I've been working through the whole film, taking it on to the next level. But most people are going to hear 5 seconds of it and then I'll be like, watch this on Netflix, Unsolved Murders of People in New York in 1987.
Well, let's go big picture on this, because you said something earlier about when you hear something again and again and again, you get sort of numb to it. So, you know, there's the idea that when a filmmaker is making something and you hear the same joke 50 times and you wonder to yourself and second guess, is the audience going to think it's funny? Do you get into situations like that where it's impacting the first couple times the orchestra plays it and then you go, is this the right thing?
Yeah, you have that when you're writing quite a lot. I mean, I'm always quite conscious of trying to capture the first memory of anything from like reading a script. Like often if I read a script, I will write something quite quickly afterwards. And that might, like literally the second I finish a script, and that might end up becoming a really big part, like much bigger. You know, I might write three things in like 20 minutes, like very fast ideas. And I might spend 3 months trying to come up with something. And often those ideas in the first 20 minutes can often be better than everything else because it's the time everything's completely fresh. Sure. When you work on a score
for ages, you go through like all kinds of things where you're like, this is so exciting, and then you're like, oh, maybe it's not that exciting, oh, maybe it's a bit shit,
and then you get around to recording it, like, oh, this is really exciting again. But it's really hard, and part of that is your thing as a composer is just trying to understand, like, part of being a composer is really a taste thing and trying to make decisions.
of what is the right decision to make for this scene or this film, and it's knowing which ones are right. And I'll have that a lot on projects. I might write something and I might feel that actually it's a really, really key thing, and the director might not always agree. I might be like, I don't like this cue, and I'll be like, no, this is really good. Like, these other ones, they're fine, but this is the real important. Like there are certain things I'll protect like crazy, and other things I'll just let go. And it's interesting when you get an idea that you know needs protecting and kind of promoting within a score. Like, I did this film, Rising Phoenix, which is about the Paralympics and disability. It's a brilliant documentary on Netflix. If you get a chance to watch it. I'm not just saying this, like, watch this thing I did, but not enough people have seen it. It's an amazing film about Paralympics. I mean, it's amazing. And there's this idea in that was like this kind of bass riff. Let's see if I've got a guitar that I can plug in. That basically went, I might be able to play it to you. Just give me 2 seconds. It's not going to sound how I want it to sound. Basically, it's just this riff you have to hear acoustically that kind of goes like, sort of like, boom, 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 boom. But it's like shoved through like tons of octave pedals and distortion. And I was suddenly like, fuck, that is a really, really useful thing that could pull this whole disparate score together. And the directors, these two guys called Peter and Ian, who are like brilliant directors and absolutely love them. But at first they were like, yeah, we kind of like it. They didn't like it the way I loved it. They liked it, but I super loved it. So I just basically said, well, look, I'm going to just never shut up about this until you either tell me to like stop, or you kind of get into it. And then eventually they really got into it, and it became like kind of a key, what became like the sort of the theme and the riff of the film, really.
Okay. So persistency, not consistency.
What's that?
Persistency, not consistency.
Well, no, it's like, it's only persistency if you believe in something. There's no point being persistent if it's not a good idea, or if the director's told you to never play them that idea ever again, which has happened to me as well on a project or two. So there's a weird thing where you've got to push really hard for what you want as a composer, but at the same time, you've got to respect the director's vision for the film. And like, directors, they're often working on these films for like years and years and years and years, you know, like on Chicago 7, Aaron Sorkin, you know, that's been around like over a decade, I think. And so you've always got to be kind of this kind of weird middle ground of like trying to bring what you do, which is like think about music and film scoring all the time, alongside what they do, which is thinking about aspects of the film that you might not even know or be on top of, in terms of, because they'll have a vision for the story or the arc and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I work in a creative industry, not sonically, but I work for an architecture firm. And a lot of times what I've learned over the years is that an idea is one thing, a sketch is another, but 99% of something is usually what it takes to sell somebody on an idea. Do you have to take things pretty much all the way through just to be able to tell people this was badass and I knew it, or, you know, it's the only way to turn someone?
Yeah, no. I mean, it's like a weird thing being a film composer, because like, I'd love to say it's all down to like the skill of being a gifted composer and musician and an artist, but a lot of it is about being a good car salesman. And there's like a kind of weird, I mean, but to be honest, that's kind of every industry. You know, if you look at like filmmakers, even people like Kubrick, right? Everyone thinks Kubrick was this like, you know, like super genius artist who had, you know, no interest in commercial side, only in the art. He knew he couldn't make the art he wanted to make without being aware of the commercial side. So with Warner Brothers, he was always like super aware of how much money his films are making, making sure they got a return on their money, making sure everyone around him, in terms of the execs, knew that he was concerned about them not losing money. Now, by doing that, he's selling himself as a purveyor of a trustworthy, you know, like you can trust him. He's got the concerns you have. Because at the end of the day, they might, obviously they want him to make a great movie, but at the end of the day, they don't really care. You know, if you got like a movie that was called the greatest movie of all time, but lost 30 million, they're going to get in the shit. So he's saying, I'm aware of what your problems are. And I think for me, I will always work hard on selling ideas and things, but it's always comes down to like what's best for the film. And you know, the thing that's interesting now, I've done so many projects, I've got like a bit more creative capital. So people believe in my stupid ideas earlier on. So I get away with a bit more freedom sometimes, which is all I really wanted. Like a lot of all this stuff, like I always say, winning Oscars or any of these awards is only useful if it allows you more creative freedom. And that's why they should exist. But that's why the purpose of awards for me, I would say, is like slightly to convince stupid people that you're good, because anyone who really, really knows their shit knows that that's a great film. That's not a great film. That score is like the best score of ever. And that one didn't deserve to win. Or, I mean, that's a bit unfair, but it's like, it's, I know what a great, you know, I have my own personal viewpoints on that. But if I was like hiring a decorator to paint this wall behind me, and there might be two people, okay, and let's say one's called Steve and one's called Susan, right? And I know Steve won the Greatest Decorator of the Year award, and Susan hasn't won anything, but actually she's an amazing decorator. Everyone in the decorating world talks about Susan the whole time. She's the best, groundbreaking decorating techniques, but I've got no idea about that world, so I just choose Steve. That's a weird metaphor, but sort of.
The big bulk of the discussion we want to talk today is the trial of the Chicago Seven. Yeah. So more or less, it's your third time working with Aaron Sorkin. And I tell you, the movie is so impacting. It took me about 4 hours to watch it because I kept rewinding things, whether it was listening to your music or I just wanted to see Mark Rylance and Eddie Redmayne have conversations. It was just, there's so much there. So you like to put a lot of thought and a lot of ideas into your scores. What were some of the first conversations you had with Aaron?
On this project, what was interesting about it was I met him. I'd read the script and I met him at the beginning of the year, like last year, in LA, which is like only time I went anywhere last year because of COVID. And he'd already like mapped out the film musically in his head, which was really cool and really unusual, because most directors kind of like often feel their way through a score and a film, because they don't always know, like it's very hard to know what a film is until you've shot it and you've seen what's working and what isn't. But he straight away was like, this film has these four pillars, which are the opening, the first riot, the second riot, and the ending. And he was like, those are the four super key bits of score, and at those moments the music's got to carry everything and being more important than everything else. Which you're like, really? Because the script's kind of doing that pretty well. They wanted the music to be really bold there, which is great, because Aaron's films, obviously there's so much dialogue. It's always an interesting juggling act between making sure all the information in the dialogue and the performance of the actors is super clear, because you have to take a lot in. And it's not like certain films where, you know, it doesn't really matter what someone's saying because they're just going to go down that road and the thing's going to blow up. But in a Sorkin movie, every word is super precious, and you've got to make sure they're really legible, and you've got to kind of like support them but not overwhelm them. And it's that difficulty of trying to find a score that can still have an individuality and a kind of musical integrity, at the same time manage to like support what's going on screen without overwhelming it. Whereas we have these four big sections where the music can actually become a lot bigger and kind of like overwhelm a bit more.
Well, yeah, the one of the things that, I mean, starting even before the movie starts, you're in the production company logos and you get Celeste just humming. I mean, yeah. Even that gets you into it. And I don't think I've heard anything that impacting since maybe James Horner's Apollo 13. I mean, Celeste didn't even have to say anything and automatically just her voice sucks you in.
Yes, I mean, Celeste is kind of like the voice of hope in that movie. Like she kind of bookends the opening and the end of the movie. And like a really key part of that score is the song that we did together called Hear My Voice. And that was kind of written about like halfway through the process. And it became apparent to me that actually the whole film, because Aaron wanted a really, he wanted a sense of release and hope at the end and optimism. And it became apparent that the whole film was moving towards this one point at the end, which is the kind of like taking the baton of 69, 68, 69 and passing it on to the generation today to understand, you know, like the parallels between then and now are not that dissimilar. And once we'd kind of started getting that song into shape, I wanted to make everything feel like it was moving towards that. That was the payoff. Again, going back to an end credit thing that we talked about only like 5 minutes ago, the importance of a musical arc during a film. And it's not just like, here's the end credit song that's got nothing to do with anything else. It's like, here's the end credit song that's completely integral to everything you've heard before. And, you know, you open with that, you open with a instrumental, like a hummed version of that theme, which is the opening. And then lots of elements of that song are being like teased in very subtly through the film. We have the melody, the ba ba ba, which is the first theme you hear at the end of the big opening when the Chicago 7 logo, Chicago 7 comes up. And then you have that theme in lots of different ways through the score, but often like kind of in a minor key or like slightly rearranged. So the idea is that by the time you get to the end, you've already like subtly understood that this is a kind of key part of the musical fabric and architecture. And the end is the payoff of everything you've been through.
Gotcha. Yeah, and you hear that, like you said, I don't know if it's a minor key or just very subtly in the stand-up cue, you know, when Tom Hayden's reading the names. And yeah, it's actually the same melody or structure that the song is based on. But which I just found impacting. And I'd love that, like you said, when you start at the beginning, you're sort of reinforcing the idea all the way through. And I have to commend you or lambast you or something. I cried twice every time I watched it, the two times. Once Eddie Redmayne starts reading the words and the soldiers' names and your music comes in, I'm like, okay, give me Kleenex, please. So.
Okay, well, that's good. That was like a big call by Aaron, because Aaron really wanted that ending really big. Like I kind of like slightly, my initial reaction was to like hold back, because I'm a kind of English European person who's not very good at going like so big on the emotion on those kind of scenes. Because Aaron's like, it's got to be big. This is it. This has got to say they've done it. And it's like, and that was interesting, because you know, that's an interesting thing where it's like my initial gut reaction was to do something slightly different for that scene, but that's how he'd envisaged the film, and it works great. It really kind of like gives this super soaring ending, which made you cry. So that's good. If someone cries, I feel I've done my job. Like, I'm like, hooray.
Great job. Well, then the other interesting, I mean, there's plenty to draw from, but the you talked about the pillars. And one thing that I found so interesting is the we're going to Chicago, which has an incredible sort of audiovisual counterpoint, because you're seeing video of napalm happening, the two assassinations, but it's this hip and brassy, almost surf music. So how did that come about?
Well, that again was Aaron's vision for the opening. He really wanted this music that actually played really against what you're seeing. Because my first attempt at that was like crazy psychedelic, like acid rock. And he was like, no, this is exactly what I don't want to do, because this is exactly what people would expect. And I was like, okay, cool, right, okay, I get it. It's like, I wasn't, and he wanted it to play like bubblegum pop, like say everything's okay, everything's great, America's fantastic, USA, USA. Whereas the reality, as people right now might be familiar with, is not that great at that time. And he wanted a sense of urgency, but an upbeatness that was not matched by the reality of what you're seeing. And that piece was unbelievably complicated. We probably worked on that piece more than any other piece in the whole film, because A, it's the opening. There's so much information to take in, and it's really important you take that information in. He wanted to introduce every character with a different part of the score, so it had to feel like it was constantly changing. Okay. It also had to feel like it was constantly building to an end and never let up. And he wanted to start at like 60 miles an hour. So it wasn't like, oh, great, we'll start at 1 mile an hour and slowly get to the end. It was like, we'll just start here and you've got to get right to here. Like, it's massive ending. So that was a and it's like a 7-minute queue. And I think we introduced like 8 or 9 or 10 different characters, all of whom has to be marked. Whole piece has to feel musically integral. Like it has to feel like a, not just like, here's another character, stop the music. You know, it all has to fit. And that was a big journey, that queue. But it's a super, you know, it's a big impactful opening, which, you know, just throws you into something straight away.
Certainly. And once that hits, then it becomes serious and you get elements like Blood in the Streets and Take the Hill. Now let's talk about Take the Hill, because that was something that just sort of progressed. It's like a bulldozer coming at you at 2 miles an hour and you just can't stop it. It's got elements of distortion and Rage Against the Machine style guitar and even like a Thai rock band feel to it. So what elements did you...
Well, I was like, with the riots, I really wanted to capture kind of the physical visceralness of those scenes and the chaos and the lack of control and the kind of, you know, when you've got these huge crowds in these riots, it's not ordered. You know, those scenes, it's not like a, you know, if you've got like a military procession of like 300 people, it's all very ordered. If you've got 300 people protesting, it's like jelly, it goes all over the place, right? And there's like no one really in charge. It's a very amorphous energy, and I really wanted to get that through in the music, which is kind of why I lent more heavily on kind of rock based instrumentation there, because I felt it's better way to get the chaos and the sort of lack of centralized power, whereas an orchestra, everything is actually quite regimented. You can write orchestral stuff that's not that regimented, but again, the very essence of an orchestra is kind of control and everyone playing together. Whereas a kind of like more loose, fucked up rock band is kind of like the opposite, where it's like you want to feel like this thing's kind of falling apart and you're just about holding it together. And so that cue is really about the building tension, like that building tension within the crowd. And it's really meant to be reflecting the crowd, that cue. And you know, the crowd start off, they're protesting, it's kind of ordered, there's a sort of repetitive militaristic sort of beat to it, but as the crowd becomes more and more angry and gets more and more unstable, the track also gets bigger, it gets more and more unstable until it gets to the sense where you're like, this has got to explode, something's got to happen, and then it explodes. And one of the other interesting things about doing Aaron's films, I guess most films, is I really try and spend a long time working out very key points in sequences, and like spend a long time re-looking at sequences and trying to work out how I can simplify things if I can, down to like a bunch of very key emotions and then working other emotions around those. So you can have some music that's incredibly reactive, you know, that's changing, like, you know, like great John Williams scoring is like super reactive, where it's doing this all the time and it's like phenomenal writing. But for something like this, I wanted something that's actually like more about big movements to like key. So if you look at like certain Morricone things, like Once Upon a Time in the West, that all builds you up to one point and it's all about that point. And there's lots of other bits in it, but it's often about landing in a certain moment. And I'm kind of quite, for a film like this, I was very interested in trying to make like 4 or 5 key points as powerful as they could be. So it'd be about building and building to those moments. And again, you look at the scene, you're like, well, what is this? What are the key moments in this scene? It's going to be building up to a police standoff. Then that's going to be a key moment. And then you're going to build up again to the riot, and then you're going to explode. And those are kind of almost like the 3 key points in the Take the Hill queue.
Well, you know, that there, again, I have to go back to USS Callister. There's something I noticed, that the symbol of the Starfleet, it's actually, the uniforms are made up of tiny little Starfleet insignias. So yeah. If you look closely, it's kind of like an Easter egg. So do you, as a composer, when you put this much thought into it and recognize the beach you have to traverse, do you put little Easter eggs in that, you know, maybe make you smile, or little nods to you know, soundtrack fans?
I don't do that for the sense of like pleasing like soundtrack nerds, so to speak, but I definitely put a lot of like small detail, like loads of small details, like tons of small details in. which are there more to like reinforce the music. So like the best example of a proper Easter egg was probably in Spider-Man for Spider-Verse, which has tons of them in. Like one of my favorite ones is in Spider-Verse is I don't know if you've seen that film, but Miles Morales is doing like spray painting early on, and we got the recordings of the spray painting, and then we turn that into record scratching. So that is his hi-hat rhythm. This is kind of hi-hat rhythm, and that's actually the sound of the spray can he's spraying when he's graffitiing with his uncle Aaron.
Oh, very nice.
And in Spider-Verse, which is probably the best score in terms of like trying to pull apart all the different conceptual elements in it, there's loads of sounds. There's tons of different sounds that are like callbacks to other moments in the film. There's a couple which are callbacks to other Spider-Man movies. That one is actually like full of Easter eggs musically, but they're often like internal Easter eggs where they're kind of like, you know, Miles has got this theme. Oh, I've got piano sounds here. Let me just have a look. We've got this kind of Miles theme, which is like, so whenever Miles is doing something that pushed him towards becoming Spider-Man, we get that, this theme. And then there's the spider, like, and when he eventually becomes Spider-Man, you get the, and but that's just like just trying to like really try and write a score that has like coherent character musical development, which is like what most film scores should really be. But okay, the realities of modern film scoring and modern directors' comments make it harder and harder to do that. But that's my favorite kind of Easter egg, where everything actually ties together. I don't really like, I always think I prefer films that reference, that create something new. I don't get very excited by like throwback references to other things, because I think the best things are where you're seeing something completely new and it's a new experience. Because I think so much of modern, there's like a lot of stuff with modern movies, which is like, we are just going to reheat a meal you liked 10 years ago, rather than like, we're going to make you a brand new meal that you've never tasted that will be phenomenal. And I think there should be more of that rather than reheats.
Well, I think that, you know, you did that with King Arthur. I mean, way to make a splash on the scene. You look at message boards, you look at YouTube comments, the sales of the record. Good luck finding that record. I mean, it's what you did with King Arthur was so unexpected, but so impacting. I mean, that and then Spider-Man, geez, it's like hit after hit. So when does something sound right to you? Because if you want to make new music and fun music,
it's hard. Some things come together quite fast. Some things come together in the studio. Like with King Arthur, a lot of stuff came together here, just me working at home, but then we'd go record and then it's, you know, I managed to work in like a lot of improvisation or like making new stuff up on the spot. That's more sonic stuff up on the spot rather than like musicality kind of elements. But like when I try and, if I'm doing a score that involves a lot of like live musicians, which hopefully is most of them, I would always try and find a way to work in some element of experimentalism and improvisation. And not necessarily like improvisation, right? Here's a bit, go and do a solo. It'll be like, right, we've got this phrase that's like dun 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 dun, and we've got it played on basses, but let's try it on something else in a weird way. And then suddenly you might get a sound, you're like, fuck, that's a really interesting sound. Let's double it up. And so I'll always try and put in an element in there that allows that, because I think there's a lot of film scoring which is done very systematically. And it can be, you can do really great results. We've got like, you know, we're turning up, there's the orchestra, here's our score, go record it, done. I kind of wish I'd do that a bit more often because it would make my life a lot easier. But
sure,
you kind of know what the result's going to be. Like the kind of artistry will be not the artistry, the uniqueness will be through the melodic writing and the musicality of the piece. But I'm always interested in trying to create like these new sonic worlds. So even on a thing like I did this film, Enola Holmes for Netflix, and it's like really minor stuff in there. There's like there was a door, I was on holiday in Greece, and I stayed in this like little Airbnb, and it had the squeakiest door you've ever heard. And I ended up sampling that and using it as like tiny little rhythms that you could hide underneath some of the string playing, and that just makes the strings just sound slightly more unusual, and you don't know what it is, and hopefully you don't listen to it and go, why is there a squeaky door on there? Whereas actually with King Arthur, you do kind of go, why is there a squeaky door on there? Because there is a squeaky door. There's a, I think one of the best things in King Arthur was, we were in Abbey Road Studio 2, and we were recording these medieval guitars, and weirdly, Phil Lord, who is one of the guys who did Spider-Verse, popped by the sessions. He was in England, and we were doing this cue, and this guy was trying to tune up his guitar, and it was this really old medieval guitar, and he's just turning the knobs. It made this noise. I was like, oh my God, that is an amazing noise. I was like, what's that? Through the talkback, and he's like, I'm just tuning my guitar. I'm like, but what was that? And he's like, oh, that's been my tuning peg. I'm like, oh my God, that is such a great noise. So we then spent about 20 minutes in an incredibly expensive recording studio with, you know, kind of expensive session musician, just going on their guitar pegs in time with the track. But it turns out, I think it's a track called Assassin's Breathe on the album, but you suddenly hear that and you're like, it just gives the whole track a different vibe.
So, You versed in music, you got exposed to it at a young age. So whether it's underground raves or you know, Alan Silvestri, who was it that you first listened to and you thought either I'd like to do this, or somebody who maybe scared you to the point with, oh, fuck, how am I going to do that? When this is the bar, how do I get into this gig?
Well, I started off doing like quite weird electronic music, and I didn't really know what I was doing. And then a director called Paul Wilmshurst had heard this record that I made when I was 16, Bedroom, and he asked me to score a TV documentary, I think when I was 17. So I was like, sure, I'll give that a go. Like, and I just had, at that time, I had one synthesizer, Korg Wave Station, and a Fostex four track, and that's all I had. Didn't even have a sequencer, have to play everything in live. So I was like, okay, I'll give that a go. And I was still at school, and I would come home, I'd do my homework, and then I'd try and work out how to score a TV show. This documentary, and it kind of worked out quite well, and he really liked it and got me to do more things with him, and then people liked what I did with him and then asked me to do stuff with them. And I basically went through it the whole time, like just kind of trying to like, shit, I don't know how to do this, so I'll just try and learn very quickly. And as a result, it's been really good for me, because I haven't had like that kind of rule-based education, or I haven't worked under a big composer who has a system which is like, this is how you do film music. I've just had to work it out my entire time. And weirdly, when I met Ridley Scott, I sort of met him, and I thought I was just meeting him for a meeting, that I was gonna be like, oh cool, I'm just meeting, you know, I've got a cool story that I met Ridley Scott. But he asked me about my career and how I'd done things, and he was just like, you're like me. He's like, I learned how to be a film director by doing advertising. He did like zillions and zillions of advertising commercials, and he's like, that's how I learned how to be a film director. And he's like, you've just done the same thing in TV to become a film composer. And I was like, that's really cool. I've got a really cool story about meeting Ridley Scott. And then he got me to do his movie, which was even crazier. So so that's kind of like how I've sort of gone through it all. It was kind of slightly with like just an element of making it up as I go along and absorbing as much as I can. Like when I was doing TV, every job I was doing, I was trying to do something different and learn anything, whether it was like from programming a synthesizer to like trying to write for an orchestra, or trying to like, how does a jazz band work? How do you record a rock band? And it was just like constantly throwing myself in the deep end. And then all those things I've sort of learned, even if I haven't learned them properly, kind of end up in my film scoring now. All these techniques that are like just odd techniques, I try and jam into my film music if I can.
Well, do you feel like, you know, I assume that working as a big budget composer, there are some more, maybe the walls close in on you and you getting into the structured world. Do any of those rules kind of bug you? Do they just make you feel uncomfortable coming from where you've come from?
There's a whole, when you're doing big budget movies, there's loads of complexity in the sense the picture's always going to change, the picture's never going to lock, they'll want demos to sound as good as they can sound. And that is a big, difficult hurdle to deal with. And every time you go in a project, you've got to look at I'm always like, how can I do the best score for this film? Because it could be like, hey, I'm going to write these demos that actually don't sound that great, but they'll sound amazing when they're done. But if you do that and they all get thrown out because you can't present them to a test audience, or you can't the execs or producers don't believe in them, then they're never going to hear that end score. So it might be I have to make demos that sound as good as they can sound, which might affect the end, the excitement of the end quality. Because there's sort of two ways of doing film music in some ways. There's the old school John Williams approach, which is here's a piano, here's the themes, turn up on the day, it'll be amazing. And the reason those scores are kind of phenomenal in a way is because they're not demoed up. And it's demoing that kind of score up is very, very complicated and almost impossible to do a lot of the things in it. It's not so impossible now, but it's whereas you have another score, which is the more kind of modern film scoring techniques, other notable composers who will base it all on samples, and the final result will not be very different to the demo. But then as a result, everything's written in a very similar way, which is very mechanical. Dun, 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 dun. To make something bigger, they just whack 20 different samples on top of it. Mm-hmm. And you've got to as a composer, just try and think, what is going to be the best way to make the most impactful and exciting score? And it's sort of navigating your way through the fog and just being okay, I'm going to try that approach. And then that both those approaches have great strengths and great limitations. So the sort of this John Williams one is amazing because it's based on a full trust of you being right, but you might not always be right. But it's very hard to visualize that score. And sometimes, people hear it and then they're like, oh shit, this isn't what I expected. Whereas the demo that sound like the finished thing, they know what they're getting, but you don't have time to make something more magical at the end. And I'm always about trying to make the end result better than the previous thing you've heard.
Gotcha. And when you mentioned before, you said you read a script and the first sort of 20 minutes are you coming up with a theme. What's your approach? Is it, do you reach for an instrument? Do you just, tap your fingers, or how do you get what's inside of you out?
It all depends on each project. Sometimes you don't get it at all. I mean, it's not I read a script and I'm suddenly here's the theme, done. It's every project is different. And that's the thing that's quite good fun about doing film music, is there's no one way to as soon as you've built a system for doing it, then your music's going to get boring. So I like the fact that there's no one system for any project, really. It's each time it's a new surprise.
Gotcha. Well, I have to say that your music is very impressive. It impresses a lot of people. I brought up Alan Silvestri earlier because I grew up with his music, Back to the Future, Fandango, Predator. What? It's amazing you could just pull that out of, I love this business. But the first time that I truly found that, in my mind as a fan, film music went to the next level was Jerry Goldsmith's Total Recall. Yeah. What in your mind did you listen to, that's great, and you heard one other thing, you go, oh my God, that's how deep this cave goes,
I went through a massive, the two composers I went through massive, massive burns on when I was quite young was Morricone and John Barry. So I basically listened to everything that John Barry's ever recorded, I think pretty much for about 4 or 5 years. And Morricone, there aren't enough hours on the planet to probably listen to everything he's done. But those are the two composers who really pushed my kind of film scoring buttons, so to speak. I think John Barry, because a sort of power of simplicity and beautiful, strong melodies, very iconic
and concise concepts, sounds, sound worlds, melodies. Morricone, I think, is more advanced in terms of like his approaches and techniques, but that's not necessarily a better thing. I think Morricone is a more exciting long-term composer in terms of his such a varied output and such a complicated and emotionally rich output. Whereas John Barry's is in some ways a bit more straightforward, but it connects with you in 2 seconds, and a great John Barry track is like just phenomenal. So those are probably the two people who really, really like sort of connected with me in terms of like great composers. But, you know, Jerry has, I've listened to some Jerry scores, and the stuff that's really fascinating is just his approach to sound, which I try and use as well, which is that thing of just trying to put all these different things in to make something new and different. And that ability to just try different medium the whole time, not get stuck in one genre and always be trying different things. And then obviously Alan's amazing, and he's a very nice person, having met him a couple of times. So I have a lot of, he was nice to my mum and dad as well. So I'm always like, classy guy.
Excellent. Excellent. That's great to hear. That's great to hear. You know, talking about Jerry, there's something about Gremlins. I listen to that and I don't know what half of the sounds I'm hearing are. And I think that, you know, when you mentioned that before about the squeaky door, it's like, that's what makes it intriguing, you know?
Yeah, Gremlins has got a lot of interesting stuff, and there's a lot of quite cool synth work. Like, it's very interesting, like, those kind of era composers, when they're working with synths within the orchestral sound, sometimes it's a bit rubbish, but sometimes it's really phenomenal. The other one I really like is Robocop, Basil
Polidorus.
I can never pronounce that, from Polidorus, which is not very fair, because that's not his name. And that, like, you know, he's so many great scores, but I absolutely love that score. I love the way it combines synth, kind of interesting, like, melodic synths, interesting like flanging techniques, along with like really powerful orchestral writing. So yeah, I'm always a fan of those kind of scores. I better go in a tick as well, sorry.
Absolutely. Well, you know, 2020 was wild for, as an understatement, it was wild for the whole population. What was the craziest thing that you think happened to you in 2020, and what are some of the exciting plans you have for 2021?
I had a week in 2020 which was like so messy, because I think I had I did a film called Birds of Prey, and they decided to have a premiere in London, and I was the only person on the crew who was English, really. And I had to work with everyone, producers, director, actors, and so when they all came en masse to London, and they all wanted to go out every night and have a night out in London, like separately. So I'd go out with one of the producers one night, then go out with the director the other night, then go out with the actors. And it was just like, just the most debauched week of drunkenness, of like me trying to work in the day and then just going out every night and ended up bowling with Margot Robbie and Robert Pattinson, and beat them all at bowling, which I was quite surprised by. That was a fun week. And then it ended with the BAFTAs, I think. And I ended up on a night with Michael Giacchino, which got very drunk as well. It's like it was a very insane week of drunkenness, where by the end of it, I think I probably have taken about 5 years off my life.
Is that where you kicked him in the privates in public?
I don't know. That was somewhere else.
Okay.
So yeah, Michael's a good guy. I'm always, you know, always trying to beat each other up.
Okay, so 2021, can drop one title that
what am I 2021? I don't know if anything I'm doing has been announced yet. What am I doing? Nothing I'm doing has been announced yet. I don't like telling anyone what I'm doing until it's kind of there in case I get fired. So hopefully
fair enough.
There's a bunch of like interesting stuff coming up in 2021, but it's all top secret at the moment.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it at that. Thank you so much for your time. Hope to connect with you about these secret projects at a future date and time, and enjoy your dinner.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Chang. Nice to speak to you.